This is the ninth shiur on Hilchos Tshuva of the Rambam, and we're starting the sixth chapter. Okay. Okay, as we said yesterday, the Rambam starts. There are many verses in the Torah and the prophets that seem to contradict the fundamental principle of free will. Most people are tripped up by these verses, and they think that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, God, decrees on a person to do evil or good, that a man's heart is not within his control to incline it in whatever direction he pleases. And I will teach you a very important principle, says the Rambam, and on the basis of this principle, you'll be able to understand these verses. Now, he introduced some general ideas, and then, in paragraph 3, Halacha Gimel, he explains the one that he wants to apply here. It could happen that a person will perform a great transgression or many transgressions until judgment, the judgment of the judge of truth, the judgment will be that the response to this crime or crimes that he did with his free will, his own understanding, that he will be prevented from doing tshuva. He will not be given the ability to return from his evil. And again, the Rambam uses throughout the word reshus for ability. Don't be confused. Reshus usually means permission. Here it's not a question of permission, it's a question of ability. In order that he should die and be lost through the transgression that he committed. And then he quotes verses, and the verses are absolutely clear that this applies to Jews as well as non-Jews. This is not limited to non-Jews. Now, and then in particular, he says it applies to Pharaoh, that God hardened Pharaoh's heart. Now, let me just give some of the factual background and then we'll analyze it philosophically. In the case of Pharaoh, there were 10 plagues. It says God hardened his heart only in the 6th, 7th, and 9th plagues. Which means that the first 5, in addition to all of the evil decrees leading up to it, were Pharaoh's own free will. Only in the 6th, 7th, and 9th did God harden his heart, take away his free will, so that he would not decide to let the people go, and thereby save himself from punishment, because, as the Rambam says, anyone who does tshuva will be spared punishment. Anyone who does tshuva. Which, as I mentioned, I want to reiterate, if you're talking about Pharaoh, you're talking about a non-Jew. And punishment, as the Rambam says in this chapter, punishment in general could be this world, the next world, or both. And therefore, to say that tshuva saves a person from punishment means saves a person from punishment in this world, the next world, and even a non-Jew could save from punishment this world and the next world. Therefore, if God wants it to be punished, and in the extreme case to be lost, God takes away his free will so that he can't do tshuva. Now, as I told you last time, for many years I thought this was a terrific kasha, a terrific problem. The whole purpose of creation is free will. The whole purpose of man's activities is free will. To take away his free will, doesn't that contradict the whole purpose of creation? And I worked out a very elaborate answer. And about 10 years years ago, I realized there's no question here at all. The whole question was silly. It just takes some time to figure these things out. And I'll tell you why I think it's silly. There's really no question here. How committed is God to man's free will? How big is his commitment, quantitatively? How much free will is God committed to give each person? There is a gigantic fact, a fact which everyone knows, which puts a strict limit on the amount of free will that each person has. That fact is death. Everybody's going to die. And when he dies, it's over. So the commitment of God to man's free will is definitely finite. Finite for each person. Furthermore, even while he's alive, there's another large-scale fact which puts a severe reduction on free will. That fact is called sleep. Right? About 30% of your life is spent sleeping, not exercising free will in your sleep. So at the outset, we have to appreciate that God's commitment to free will is strictly limited. Now, given that thought, here's how to look at Pharaoh. Pharaoh has his career, and he does various things, including some terrible crimes. And God says, for my money, your life is over. You don't deserve any more life. I don't owe you any more life. Your career is finished. It's just that you're useful to me. So I'll prop you up as a kind of robot, the living dead, you know, walking through life under my control. From the point of view of life and death, you could be dead and buried already. It's just that I'll preserve you a little bit longer because I want you to do certain things for my purposes. Why would there be any contradiction here to free will and responsibility and all the rest? No contradiction at all. Even if he becomes a robot, there's no contradiction at all. So I don't see any gigantic problem here that a person can get to the point where, because of the actions that he chose freely, the actions he did freely, the decree is that at this point he should lose his free will. Is everybody with me? Okay, good. I don't think this is a serious issue here at all. Now, let's register what I said yesterday. I want to repeat it again. If a man commits terrible crimes and God says, listen, I want you to be punished. I don't want you to have any way out. There are really two solutions to the problem. One is, don't let him do tshuva. That's the Rambam solution. Take away his free will so he won't do tshuva. Theoretically, there's another possible solution. And that is, let him do tshuva. That's even worse. That's certainly taking away his free will, right? It's just another more extreme way of taking away his free will. Let him do tshuva and punish him anyway. Just say tshuva isn't enough. He did such a terrible crime. This repair isn't helpful enough to overcome it. The Rambam avoids that. The Rambam says that's not a possible repair. The Rambam is on record that tshuva works for everything, no matter how serious the crime, no matter how irreversible the consequences. Murder makes no difference. Tshuva will stop punishment for everything. Now, it's not exactly obvious why that should be so. If the Rambam had told us, tshuva works up to here, and beyond that, tshuva is just not powerful enough to take away the crime, and you get punished anyway, I think we would have understood it. We wouldn't have had any problems with that. I'm just pointing out, the Rambam's on record that it doesn't work that way. Tshuva is absolutely effective, always, under all conditions. Like the verses in Isaiah that we read. And therefore, if God is committed that this person must be punished, the only way to do it is by taking away the possibility of doing tshuva, which means to take away free will. Now, I want you to know that this is not the only way to read the sequence with Pharaoh. There are commentators who read it differently. They say God hardened Pharaoh's heart to preserve his free will. Not to take away his free will, but to preserve his free will. What does that mean? A person can be so battered, so pressured, so overwhelmed that the circumstances remove his free will. And then by strengthening him and encouraging him, You restore his free will. I'll give you two examples. A prize fighter, and it's right after the eighth round. And he's got beaten up and knocked down, and one eye is shut with bruises. And he comes back to the bench, and he says to his coach, "Let's give up. I can't go out there again. You know, it's just too much. I'm overwhelmed. I can't go back. I go back out there again." He's overwhelmed with the punishment that he's taken. He's just saying, "I can't do it." Now the coach says, "Listen, you can't do it. We'll try. You'll get some points. You know, it won't be so embarrassing to get knocked out. You know, TKO and all the rest." What's the coach doing? The coach is enabling him to decide to go back out there. He's restoring his freedom. In the Second World War, when Americans went to Europe to fight, now this was America, which hadn't had a war in 30 years, and 10% of the American troops, when they first came under fire, froze. They just froze. They couldn't shoot, they couldn't duck, they just stood there like penguins. And the enemy's shooting at them, and they're standing there. They just froze. They couldn't. They just the tension and the fright was so great that they couldn't move. This led to all sorts of psychological programs and to try to help them. But the guy's standing there frozen, and the bullets are flying around, and you yell at him, "Come on, get down there!" What are you doing? You're trying to restore his free will. Right now he's frozen. He's lost his free will. So they say when God hardened Pharaoh's heart, it wasn't to take away his free will, it was to restore his free will. Now, when I read that, I thought to myself, this is how careful you have to be and why it's so important to read the commentators. What seems to be the obvious, plain, clear meaning of the text might be, at least not the only way to take it. There might be another way to take it if you're a revolving genius. And if you spent your whole life studying the text and you gave your comments to posterity, if you read those people, you might learn something. And therefore, the text doesn't have to be understood as God taking away their Pharaoh's free will. But the Rambam does take it that way, and the explanation of it is as I've told you. Okay, all together? I don't know why they turned off the air conditioner, but I think we're going to need it because the air is very dead in here. Turn it back on. Yes.
You gave Pharaoh as an example of a non-Jew that, you know, Hashem might have taken his free will away, depending on how you look at this. Can you give us an example with a Jew?
Sure. He quotes from Isaiah. Says to Isaiah, "Let the heart of this people be fat, so that they should not hear when they're given instructions to return, so they shouldn't hear and shouldn't take notice," meaning that they shouldn't hear, shouldn't take notice, and they should be lost. He quotes another verse. These are verses that refer to the Jewish people. Kolomar, says the Rambam, they sinned with their own free will, and they added many crimes to the point where the appropriate response is to prevent tshuva. Tshuva, which is the cure, prevent it. Okay. Then says the Rambam, and you'll probably think of this if you go through the text as we come to the next year. Why then does he send Moses to Pharaoh and say, "Send out the people"? What's the point of sending Moses to tell him to send the people out when God has hardened his heart so that he won't send the people out? It's like shadow boxing. He says, in order to teach the people who come into the world, later generations, that when God prevents a person from doing tshuva, prevents the sinner from doing tshuva, he can't tshuva, he cannot do so, and he'll die in his wickedness that he did beforehand with his own free will. In other words, the whole sequence with Pharaoh is to inform the world of this principle, that a person can get to the point where the rule from God is that he should lose his free will in order to prevent him from doing tshuva. And Sichon Og, the kings of the Canaanites, and so forth and so on. He says the Jewish people in the times of Elijah, who committed terrible crimes. God prevented tshuva from them. That's what the prophet says. You turned their heart back. God says, you're right. I turned their heart back. I definitely did that. Because they got to the point where tshuva was not appropriate for them. Comes out, says the Rambam, God did not decree that Pharaoh should treat the Jewish people wickedly, nor Sichon and the rest of them. Nor did he decree on the Jewish people they should serve idols. But they committed crimes with their own free will. And then the judgment was because of that, that they should lose their ability to do tshuva. Now, I think the Rambam may be hinting to something more here. I mentioned this to you in the past, and I'll just show you how it applies here. What happens when a person gets drunk and goes driving and smashes into something? And when they hold him before the court and he says, I didn't choose to smash into it, so I'm not responsible. You know very well, you're only responsible for actions you chose. I didn't choose this. I didn't choose anything. I was blind drunk. What will we say to him? Excuse me, you chose to get drunk. See, in Israel, they have advertisements. When you're drinking, give the keys to one friend who isn't drinking. Bishvil zeh yesh chaverim. That's what you have friends for. You have friends to hold the keys so you shouldn't try and just drive yourself into a pole. That's where Israeli culture is standing. But you didn't. You went and got drunk, and you kept the keys, and you went driving afterwards. So even though later, when you smashed into something, you didn't choose it. Indeed, at that point, you couldn't choose it. Listen carefully. You couldn't choose. You lost your free will. You were drunk. Even so, you're responsible for what you did because you put yourself in that condition. Now, it could be that Rambam is using a similar idea here. There is a rule of justice. The rule of justice says that free will is a tremendous gift and that a person who misuses it too terribly loses the right to use it anymore and can be prevented from doing tshuva so as to avoid punishment for his crimes, then maybe what he does later when he's lost the free will to do tshuva, he's responsible for. He's responsible for, even though he's not choosing it, but he, by his own free choices, put himself in the position where he can't choose anymore. Now someone will say, well, but he couldn't do tshuva. That's true. But the reason he couldn't do tshuva is because he committed such crimes that, according to justice, it's not appropriate to allow him to do tshuva. So his failure to do tshuva later, even though it's beyond his ability, he'd still be responsible. And then the loss of free will would not entail a loss of responsibility. And then there wouldn't be any problem at all. So I think the Rambam may be hinting at that. He doesn't say it very clearly, but it's clear enough. Okay, now, at the end of this chapter, the Rambam introduces another problem and has a very subtle solution. A person may say, wasn't Abraham told in prophecy that his descendants will be strangers in a land not theirs, and the owners of the land will put them to work, or the Jews will serve the owners of the land, that's probably better, sorry. The Jews will serve the owners of the land, and the owners of the land will afflict them, cause them pain. Doesn't that sound like God has decreed the Egyptians shall oppress the Jews? That the decree on the Egyptians that they shall oppress Jews. Implication being, if God decreed it, how then can you blame the Egyptians? How can you punish the Egyptians for it? God decreed it. And isn't it written, God says, this people, meaning the Jewish people, will get up and will stray after the gods, the strange gods of the land. Here again, God decreed on the Jewish people to serve idols. And if so, why did he punish them? The Egyptians for oppressing the Jews, and the Jews for serving idols. Now listen to the Rambam's answer. I'll read it to you and translate, and then we'll discuss it. Because God did not decree on any particular person that he will be the one, or among the ones, to stray after the other gods. Rather, every one of them made his own choice to serve idols. And if he had wanted not to serve, he would have been able not to serve. That's one answer. Then he goes on to express what I think is a separate answer. So let's try to understand this. God says, this nation shall serve other gods. Let's think of that as a decree. The second answer, I think, is that it's really not a decree. I hope it's a second answer. If the two go together, I don't understand how they go together. But let's take the first one. He didn't decree on any particular person. He didn't say, Reuven, to be born in 1416 in Tzfas, to parent so-and-so, you know, he's going to be the one to serve idols. Had he decreed on a particular person that he would serve idols, seems the Rambam is implying, then indeed he shouldn't be punished. But no, the decree was general. It wasn't for any specific person. Therefore, for any particular person who says, yes, it's true that I served idols, but there was the decree, we say to him, listen, the decree didn't mention you. It wasn't on you. It was a general decree. Had you decided not to, you could have managed not to. So you're responsible for serving the idols. You did it with your own free choice. Against that argument, there's a very natural intuition. What do you want to say against that argument? Well, suppose everyone had decided not to serve idols. Then the decree wouldn't have come true, would it? So, in order for the decree to come true, somebody's got to do it. You can't tell me we all had free will not to serve the idols, because if all of us had exercised our free will not to serve the idols, then the decree wouldn't have come true. So it can't be that we all have free will. It's just not true. If you take the decree as a decree, and you understand that God's decree must come true, then how can you say that we all had free will? Now, if you listen very carefully, you'll notice that I shifted my vocabulary. I shifted my vocabulary to make the objection sound reasonable. I believe the Rambam's argument here is sound. I believe it just needs a little care in articulating it. It's really in his words. And the trick is in where I shifted the vocabulary in stating the problem. I thought up an analogy for this. The dictator has chosen 10 people. And he says to them, you're going to engage in a race. The first 4 people who come in will live. The last 6 will die. And they run. No, I'm sorry, that's not how it goes. If you make it in a certain amount of time and you're among the first 4, then you live. In order to live, you got to make it in a certain amount of time and be among the first 4. If you miss out on the time, you die. And if you're not among the first 6, you don't die. The first 4, you die also. What happens? The 10 run and 2 make it within the time period. So the king says, okay, 2 made it within the time period, 2 live and 8 die. So one of the ones who's going to die says to the king, boy, are you wicked. You're evil, you know. You're just wiping people out. And the king says, listen, I've timed you on other races. I know how strong you are. You could have made it within within the time period. You decided to be lazy. You decided to be lazy. You could have made it. So don't tell me that I'm wiping you out. viciously. As a matter of fact, you could have made it. If you're dying, it's because of your laziness. Now the runner says back, you're right, actually. I could have made it. But we couldn't all have made it because you said it has to be the first four. If we had all made it within the time period, then still six would have died. That's true. That's true. If they had all made it within the time period, then six would have died. It's true, but it's irrelevant. Because that truth talks about a fairy world. A world that didn't happen. Another world, you know, out there beyond Jupiter. If our world were different, if water were wine, the world would be a very different place. But it isn't wine. It's water. The king says, yeah, if everybody had made it within the time period, and then the six people would have died, then it would have been unjust. But that's not what happened. What happened was every one of you eight could have made it within the time period. So each one of you could have decided to live. So each one of you is dying only because of his own decision. The objection back comes from a hypothetical. But if it had worked out differently, then things would have had to have been different, and then things would have been wrong. Maybe so. And maybe that gives you some doubts about the character of the king, that he set up such a thing. But you can't claim in the real world that there was an injustice, because in the real world, to each one of the eight, the king is right to say, you could have saved yourself. You lost because you're lazy. This is a world in which the other seven were lazy, and you were lazy. Given that the other seven were lazy, had you made the right choice and run well, you could have saved yourself. Don't tell me about what would have happened if everybody else had run well, and then six would have died, even though they made the time period. That's not what happened. So the Rambam says, over here, let's say 50% of the Jews was the number that served the idols. Now, say to this particular Jew, you serve the idol, you're going to be punished. And he says, but there was a decree. A decree that the Jewish people should serve idols. And the Rambam's response is, okay, there was a decree, but it didn't mention you. Didn't pick you out. It just said, there will be. You could have chosen otherwise. After all, if it's 50% or 50% minus 1, that's not going to change the decree. There are a large number of people. 50% minus 1 isn't going to change the decree at all. It will come true with 50% minus 1. Now the Jew says, but look, if everybody had decided not to serve the idols, then the decree wouldn't have come out true. And then what? You would have forced us or whatever else. So the Rambam says back, yeah, if water were wine, the world would be a very different place and all the results would be different. But it isn't that way. As a matter of fact, 50% did serve. And therefore, you could have made it 50% minus 1 and everything would have come out the way it was predicted, or the way it was decreed, I should say. And therefore, you have no excuse. You have no way out. This is a very, I think, a very sharp observation of the Rambam, that since all these statements are general statements, none of them specifies what a particular person is going to do, a decree that's general does not give any excuse to the particular individuals who choose to come under that decree. Okay? That's one solution the Rambam gives. Then he goes on to say, even though the words here are a little difficult, the words sound like they're continuing the same thought, although there's a vav, and the vav could mean and, meaning a separate thought. I'm not 100% happy with the words, but the gedank is, the idea, as far as I understand, I think is okay. Furthermore, he says, why must you read those verses as a decree? They could be taken just as information. I'm informing you as to what's going to happen. This is the way of the world. Just as, he says, if God will say that in this people there will be righteous and wicked. A statement that this people will have in it righteous and wicked will not give an excuse for the wicked person to say, oh, see, I'm not responsible for being wicked, because God said there'll be righteous and wicked. God saying there'll be righteous and wicked is just saying that's the way people are. Some choose to be righteous and some choose to be wicked. It doesn't mean the wicked person didn't choose, and it doesn't mean he's not responsible. God is just describing the way things generally are. And the same with the Egyptians. Each Egyptian made his own choice. And that being the case, he's responsible for his own choice. Even if there's a general statement even if it were a general decree, and all the worse so if it's just a prediction, the person is responsible for the actions that he chooses. Okay, we're together, I take it. Chapter 7 is mostly how important tshuva is, and how about tshuva should behave. I want to try to do a little bit in chapters 8, 9, and 10 as much as I can. The Rambam says in chapter 8, the great good which is hidden for the tzaddikim, the righteous, is life in the world to come. And this is life that has no death. And it is the good that has with it no evil. He quotes a verse. And the oral tradition interprets the verse. The reward for the righteous is that they merit that peaceful beauty of the world to come. And the punishment for the wicked is that they do not merit that life, but they are cut off and die. Anyone who does not merit this life, the life of the world to come, he is the one who is dead, who does not live forever. But he is cut off in his wickedness, and he's lost like an animal. That's what the Torah says when it talks about being cut off. Now, I must tell you that not everybody agrees with this. There are those who say that no one could be ultimately lost, completely lost. I should finish the statement in paragraph 1. That soul which left the body in this world does not merit the life of the world to come, but it's cut off for the world to come as well. Others, like the Ramban, hold that a soul cannot be lost. The very idea of a soul being lost is an impossible idea. And he brings a very interesting indication of it. Listen to what he says. He says, even in the physical world, nothing is ever lost. Things just get transformed, but nothing disappears. He had a kind of primitive concept of conservation of energy, right? Conservation of mass energy. Nothing gets lost. You burn up a piece of wood, it becomes smoke and ash. It doesn't get lost. Nothing disappears. If in the physical world nothing disappears, how could a soul disappear? Soul whose being is infinitely elevated above this world. This is inconceivable, impossibility. And all of the statements in the Talmud, which sound like being utterly annihilated, the Ramban analyzes to show that it shouldn't be understood that way. Okay, I'm not going to fight that battle. I just want you to know that this is a controversial item. Ramchal, in the writings of the Ramchal, there's an open contradiction. In the Derech Hashem, he says at least 3 times that certain people could be lost. In the Asara Prakim, he says no. In the Pachud, he says even more clearly no. Not clear. Not clear. But the Rambam's position here is that kores means being cut off, and cut off means being annihilated, lost, ceasing to exist. Now he says, the next world has no body. No body, no bodily form. Just souls. Without a body. Like angels, he says. And therefore, since there's no body, there's no eating and no drinking, and none of the bodily activities that human beings normally perform in this world. And the incidents that take place via the body don't apply in that world. Like sitting, standing, sleep, death, sadness and laughter. He identifies those as bodily conditions and other similar conditions. This is what the early sages said, he's quoting the Gemara. The world to come, there's no eating, there's no drinking, no sexual relations. The righteous sit and their crowns birashehem. I'll explain that in a minute. Enjoying the presence of God, the shine of God's presence. Behold, he says, it's clarified to you in this statement that there's no body there. That's why there's no eating and drinking. When they said they're sitting, I'm sure some of you had alarm bells ringing. The way they say they're sitting, that's only an analogy. That's not meant literally. That is to say, they're there without effort, without strain, like a person who's sitting. Not that they're really sitting. And he says, the strict words of the crowns is, the crowns are berashehem. Anybody know how to translate that? No.
In their heads.
It's in their heads. Berashehem. Not al roshehem, but berashehem. And the Rambam takes this very seriously. Their crowns are in their heads. Kelomar, that is to say, their knowledge with which they understand, which is why they're in the world to come altogether, is present with them, and that is their crown. Their crown is the knowledge that is in their heads. Not that they're wearing gold. They don't have a body, so it can't be that. Okay. Now, this position, that there's no bodies, there are no bodies in the world to come, is very, very controversial. Indeed, since the Rambam, especially with the spread of the Kabbalah, I don't think anybody takes this position anymore. Anybody. And even in his own time, there were those who disagreed with him. Indeed, the Yad Rama, among others, turned the Rambam's proofs against him. When the Talmud says there's no eating and drinking and physical relations or sleep, why did the Talmud pick out those specific functions? If there's no body, then there are no functions at all. So then why pick out a few and say they're in the Talmud took them as sort of typical. Since there aren't these, you don't have a body, and therefore you're not doing anything. But the Yad Rama says, why do it that way? If you really mean that it's absolute, there's no body at all, then you shouldn't have simply said there's no body. Why say there's no eating and drinking? Well, why are eating and drinking special? It must be that eating and drinking are particular activities, but the body's there, it's just not eating and drinking. Like Moses on Mount Sinai, who was there for 40 days and 40 nights, and didn't eat and didn't drink, but he had a body. Didn't lose his body. The alternate view, which you can find in the Ramchal, in Luzzatto, in the Das Tvunos, the Understanding Heart, at some length, is this. Listen carefully, because this is rather surprising to most people. We're talking about conservation principles. Everything God created is eternal. Everything! That includes the mosquitoes, blades of grass, motes of dust. It's all eternal. Souls, bodies, hair follicles, you know, all of it. But what? It doesn't stay in its present form. It gets transformed. Fundamentally transformed. The world as a whole, human being, the body, even the soul in a certain sense, but the body principally, gets transformed. It gets sanctified. It gets spiritualized. That transformation is really utterly an utter transformation. But it is a transformation of the physical as we have it into that other state. I don't know if I can give you an analogy. I'll give you a couple of analogies which are just hints. You observe the crawling caterpillar. And you study it, you catalog it, and categorize it, and so forth and so on. And then you observe the flitting butterfly. I don't think that you would ever associate them. What could one possibly have to do with the other? Of course, there's a process called metamorphosis, where the one turns into the other. That creeping, crawling, multi-legged little grunt turns into a butterfly. That's really astounding. But it is. It is the erstwhile crawling thing, and now it's got wings and flies around. Beautifully colored wings from a nondescript little crawling runt. Or someone who's not very cultured goes to the bookshop, and he picks up a book, and he opens it up, and he sees, says, "What's this?" And he sees dots all over the page, and sees lines and lines. And so he says, "Oh, you want to know what that is?" Presses a button, and out comes Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. He says, "I asked you about the book, and you're playing music." But Mike, what are you doing? I asked you what's in the book. He said, "Yeah. What's in the book is that." Because this is the score of Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. A score is what the conductor reads to tell all the instrumentalists what to play. Right? So in a certain sense, it's all there in the book. You can't hear the book. If you put your ear very close to the page, you're not going to hear any music. Okay, on the book, it's the music in written form, and then there's the auditory experience. Are they related? Yeah, in a certain sense. Ask any musician. He looks at the notes and he plays the music. So the idea that a thing could change to a different form of existence, but there's a very important relationship between the score and the music. The score contains every music, every note that's played. They're all there. Indeed, the last half of Beethoven's career, he was deaf. When he composed his greatest compositions, he was deaf. And as he wrote each note, he sort of heard them in his head without anybody playing it. He just looked at the stuff on the paper and he heard it. So, according to Ramchal, the whole of the physical world is saved, but it's saved with a very radical transformation. It all becomes spiritualized and all goes into Olam Haba. Here's an analogy coming from the sources that the Ramchal used. Let's suppose you have a spark that's giving off light, enclosed in an opaque shell. Because it's enclosed in an opaque shell, the light can't spread. We want to enable the light to spread unrestrictedly. There are two ways to do it. One way to do it is to obliterate the shell, and then the light will spread. The other way is to render the shell transparent. If you make the shell transparent, the light will spread. Indeed, if you know a little physics, the shell aids in the spreading of the light. That's how your eyeglasses work. When the light comes through your eyeglasses, it isn't the same as when it comes out, different from the way it went in, because the light interacts with the molecules of the glass. That's why the speed of light in glass is not the same as the speed of light in empty space. It doesn't just go through the spaces in the glass. So if the shell becomes transparent, but it's still there, it's an ally to the spread of the light. And if light's coming in, it's an ally to the receiving of the light. That's the Jewish solution. That's the Torah solution. The body, the physical, which was a block to the light, is, so to speak, rendered transparent and becomes an ally of the light, but it's not lost. Now, I taught this Rambam. I'm teaching this Rambam for many years. And I taught the contrast with the, what we call the Kabbalistic position. Until a few years ago, when I read something else in the Rambam, and I think that the contrast is not nearly as great as I once believed. On the surface, it seems, the Rambam says there's no body. No body. And Kabbalists say there is body, though transformed. But in the Shmona Prakim, Rambam's introduction to Pirkei Avos, the end of the first chapter, he makes a very interesting observation. He says, human beings grow. So do trees grow. Human beings see. So do cows see. Human beings walk. So do cows walk. Human beings have desires. So do cows have desires. Then human beings have free will, have knowledge of good and evil. How should we picture this? Is it that there's a growth principle in the world? That growth principle applies to plants, to animals, and humans. There's a perception principle in the world that applies to animals and humans. There's a desire principle in the world that applies to animals and humans. Then there's free will that applies only to humans. Humans have the items from the lower world plus an additional item like free will and understanding and things like that. Is that the way to look at it? The Rambam says no. That's wrong. The truth is that a human being has a divine soul, and that dictates all of the human being. It dictates his growth. It dictates his perception. It dictates his desire. It dictates his locomotion and his intelligence and his free will and everything. It's all under the divine soul. All of it. Not everybody agrees to this. The Ramban considers both views, and he's opts for this for the first view. But that's the Ramban's position over there in the Shmona Prakim, that it's all under the control of the divine soul. Okay, so now let's ask about this divine soul in the world to come. The Rambam doesn't indicate that the divine soul loses any of its content. That's the divine soul. But now, part of the divine soul is a module which directs the legs to walk. Another part of the divine soul is a module that directs the eyes to see. Another part of the divine soul is a module that directs the body to grow. What are those modules doing up there? There's no legs to walk, and there's no body to grow, and there are no eyes to see. Still, the modules in the soul that direct that activity are still there. That doesn't sound too different from what the Ramchal describes as this ultimately transformed body, which becomes an ally of the soul in spreading and receiving the light. The end state sounds very similar in the two cases. Only how you get there sounds different. For the Ramchal, nothing is lost. Everything is preserved and transformed. For the Rambam, all of the physical is lost. But look what he's built into the spiritual. He's built into the spiritual physical consciousness and physical direction. And in the world to come, it just doesn't do anything because there's nothing physical there for it to direct. So I realized a number of years ago, I believe this is correct, that the gap between the Rambam on the one hand and the Kabbalists on the other hand is not nearly so great as I once believed. There are nuances of difference. There's some difference in the description of how you get there. But to paint it as a gigantic gap in their conceptions, that in the one you have the physical and the other one you don't, I think is ultimately a mistake. And this is, I would say this happens over and over again in Jewish scholarship, that things that look like gigantic difference of opinion very often turn out to be matters of nuance and emphasis rather than fundamentally different positions. Yes? No, the only thing is fine, but just to add to your remarks, what they say is that everyone has a fatal disease. It's called life. Because everyone who lives dies. So everyone must have a fatal disease. No, when you get to Olam Abba, to the world to come, there is continuous transformation. I was only talking about the transformation of the physical to become an ally of the spiritual. I didn't say anything about a transformation of the spiritual. We didn't talk about that. So I'm not saying that all transformation stops, just this particular type of transformation stops. Okay? All right, we'll continue tomorrow, Mr. Shem. Look to you.
Yeah. 2 weeks ago, it was early Rosh
here. Yeah.
Francis said, right, we talked about the relationship between the difficulty of making a choice and the responsibility for the choice.
Yes.
And then also the relationship between